This is the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Our aim is to educate and inform you, explore and expand your passion for aviation, and entertain you a little along the way. Our guest this episode is Igor Sikorsky III, grandson of aviation pioneer Igor Sikorsky. Each year, Igor conducts the Sikorsky Weekend at the Bradford Camps in the North Maine Woods. It's an opportunity to immerse yourself in the history of Igor's grandfather with family memorabilia, stories, and videos. Igor gives us a taste of some of that history, and David's airplane of the week is the Sikorsky VS-300. Also, we look at Boeing's belief that the industry has put its cyclic business nature in the past, new fees proposed for air travelers, and the International Trade Commission report denying Boeing's claim against Bombardier. All that and more coming up right now. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 491 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and joining me first is Brian Coleman, our associate producer. Brian, happy birthday.
Oh, you stole my line. I was going to I was going to say, you know, today's President's Day that we're recording, and everyone is welcome for having the day off today because I
Who had the day off?
Oh, you're one of the few people that had to work today. Sorry to hear that. But yes, today is my birthday.
Wonderful. Well, happy birthday again. And also with us is Max Trescott. He's host of Aviation News Talk podcast. He was the 2008 CFI of the year, and he's an expert on learning to fly and purchase a Cirrus aircraft. Max T, how are you?
Hey, I'm great. In fact, I just got back a couple of days ago from bringing a brand new airplane across the country, so that was a fun dash through the snow and ice. So lots of adventures on that trip, but we succeeded, which is all that counts.
Boy, you've been putting in some serious amount of flying time lately.
Oh yeah, it's true. I've been flying 6-7 days a week, and sometimes at the airport for 11-12 hours a day. So it's crazy, man. Good. I don't know what's going on, but people love to fly.
That's great. Also with us is our aviation historian, David Vanderhoof. Hi, David.
Hey, Max, and I'm proud of myself. I'm actually going to do a history segment tonight, so I get to earn the title of historian. However, in the history of the universe, this is going to be one of the tougher ones when you are writing for the grandson of the person you're going to talk about. That's a real challenge to get away with. So, but that leads us into our guest, doesn't it?
It sure does. Our guest this episode is Igor Sikorsky III. Now, he's the grandson of aviation pioneer Igor Sikorsky. Igor and his wife, Karen, operate the Bradford Camps in the North Maine Woods, and each year they conduct the Sikorsky Weekend, which is an opportunity to, well, really immerse yourself in the history of Igor's grandfather with family memorabilia and stories and videos. Igor, welcome back to the Airplane Geeks Podcast.
Hey, thank you. I'm very, very happy to be here. I really appreciate the invite, and this is fun stuff. You guys do a great job.
Oh, thank you, and we really enjoy having you on. And of course, some years ago, you know, it's probably been longer than I can remember. My wife and I participated or went up to the camp for the Sikorsky Weekend and had just a wonderful, wonderful time.
That's right. That was good. It's been going on for 15 years or so. It used to be myself and my father. He's getting to the point where just too long of a trip for him. And we've even had some years when my dad, my uncle Sergey, my uncle Nicky, and my uncle George were there. So that was a gaggle of Sikorskys. All those four brothers were, you know, running around in the backyard of the Sikorsky plant when my grandfather was tinkering on his VS-300 design back in late 30s.
Where else are you going to get an opportunity for something like that? Now you're a pilot, of course. Do you still have the Skyhawk?
I do. I fly it almost 200 hours a year. It's part 135 air taxi stuff. And the Skyhawk it's a real workhorse. It lifts some eyebrows when people think that I'm trying to do something with a Skyhawk, but it's got the Penyan 180 horse engine in it and stole wings and big floats, big Bauman floats. And I do literally, I we'll use that word, but literally have a 960-pound useful load. So and the thing likes flying, likes going up. So it's a nice, simple airplane to maintain, a joy to fly. And I think, like I said, I fly maybe 200 hours a year, but that is about encompasses about 400 flights a year. So you do a lot of short stuff.
All up in the North Maine woods, I guess, a lot of flying to the lakes. And all. Of course, the camp itself is on a lake. And we'll be talking about that and your flying coming up and Sikorsky weekend and some other things about the history of Sikorsky coming up soon. But first, we want to just touch on a little bit of the aviation news from the past week. So is everyone ready?
Ready from the West.
First item comes from CNBC, from the Boeing CEO. Aerospace now viewed as an industry with, quote, long-term sustained growth. Well, the Boeing CEO, Dennis Muilenburg, has said that the industry has gone, quote, from being a high-cycle business in the past to now becoming a long-term sustained growth business. Back in the in the early days of my career, we always thought of the airline industry as kind of going from feast to famine. You'd see the reports in the press and the profits would be astronomical and huge percentages increase over the prior year. And then after a few years, it would just dive in the opposite direction. And just a very cyclic business with the average not being all that spectacular. The Boeing CEO says those days are behind us. Stability is always good, especially if you're trying to run a major corporation. What do you think, Brian? Do you think this is good news for the industry, basically?
Well, I think it's certainly good news for the industry, but I wonder, is this actually sustained growth or is this just a really large backlog? I know both Boeing and Airbus have a ton of aircraft on back order. And if you were an airline and wanting to take delivery today, you wouldn't be able to for quite some time in the future, I guess, unless if you bought someone else's slot. But unless if they could really increase capacity, I don't know, I'd question, is this sustained growth?
Well, that's an interesting point. And that's what crossed my mind is we're in a period now that's driven by steady delivery of aircraft, basically, at high volumes, at high production rates. And that that makes it not cyclical, in a sense. Of course, the backlog is gigantic, and it extends out for many, many years. But, hey, I think anything could happen.
Yeah, this kind of reminds me of one of the airline CEOs, perhaps, what, 6-9 months ago, said they have changed and the airline is now seeing permanent profitability, that there was no longer going to be any cyclicality to that their industry as well. I mean, if you can take a look at the stock market as just one indicator, yeah, it's been up and to the right for perhaps 9 years. But you know, I don't think that is a permanent change. I think that you know, there's going to be some economic shock to the markets at some point, and airlines are going to, you know, find that they're not going to have increasing sales, and the airline, and you know, the airframers are going to have some kind of bump along the way as well. But anyway, good for them. I hope they're right.
Sure, sure.
And if Boeing was so unworried about sustained growth, why did they go after Bombardier?
Oh yeah. Well, that's an interesting point.
And David, my other point to that is, with this growth and opportunity, don't you think they should be dumping an awful lot of resources into the what could be called the 797 in the middle of the market aircraft and really jumpstart that? Because to me, it certainly seems like Airbus is kicking their butt in that segment of the market as well.
I tell you one thing, though. I wish I'd bought a lot of Boeing stock a year or 2 years ago, because their stock price is just, it's just really gone through the roof. I think about over 100% in the last 12 months. So that's a rate of return that's hard to beat.
But that's because they're buying all the sort of drone companies that we've been talking about on that other show.
Yeah, that's it.
Not because of tubes with wings.
Well, we have another story. This is from Travel Pulse. New aviation fees could cost travelers $3 billion. And this comes from taking a look at the proposed 2019 budget in the United States that was released on February 12th. It calls for increases in TSA and Customs and Border Protection, CBP, fees. But the budget proposal would increase the TSA passenger security fee $1 per one-way trip next year. And then in 2020, it would increase it an additional $1.65. So the total would be $8.25 per one-way trip by 2020. That's the TSA passenger security fee. And then there's also the CBP fees for international travelers, and those would increase under this proposed budget from $5.65 to $8.40. And then the immigration user fee would increase to $9 from $7. It's not a large increase in sort of dollar value per customer, but you got a lot of flying customers, and it adds up to some serious change.
Yeah, and especially when I feel I get about 25 cents worth of value out of that $8.25 TSA fee. I know, as the article points out, the money's not really being spent on TSA and Customs and Border Patrol. The money's being moved and being used elsewhere within the government. And I personally sure would like to see the money spent where it was collected for.
Yeah, and that's what Airlines for America is pushing. They, of course, want Congress to reject any TSA or CBP security fee increases. And like you say, Brian, the article here says, Airlines for America says Congress should endeavor to return the billions of dollars that are presently being collected by the TSA and CBP and redirect them to pay for non-aviation related purposes, or that were redirected for non-aviation purposes. The only good news from this, I guess, if you're interested in not seeing the fee increases, is that last year, the Senate Appropriations Committee had approved a spending bill that did include an increase in the passenger facility charge, yet another fee. In fact, that would allow airports to charge passengers up to $34 per trip, up from the current $18. But we see in this budget proposal that passenger facility charge fee is not in, that increase is not in the proposed budget. A4A is very happy about that.
Yay.
Yeah. All right, and one more item. This is just really kind of a follow-up, and as we've talked in the past about this Boeing charge that Bombardier was dumping C-Series aircraft in the United States, especially the 110-seat C-Series jets that were ordered by Delta. And we had mentioned previously that the International Trade Commission had rejected Boeing's claims, but we were waiting for the final report to come from the ITC. And that's out now. We'll have a link to this in the show notes. It's a 194-page ruling, but the ITC says that Boeing lost no sales or revenue when Delta Airlines ordered the C-Series aircraft. The 110-seat C-Series jets ordered by Delta and Boeing's 737 MAX 7 plane do not compete. Boeing lost no sales or revenue. So there's the final word. And, of course, we speculated last time we talked about this as to what Boeing may do next, because there is another appeal step that's theoretically possible. At the time, we said that Boeing would probably want to see what the logic was behind the ITC's ruling. And so it's out now, and we'll have to wait and see what Boeing does.
Hey, Max, what I'd really like to know is, why did it take them 197 pages to say Boeing wasn't hurt? It just seems excessive words.
Well, you know, it's a government document. But also, because maybe, I'm speculating, because of the possibility that there could be an appeal, they want to provide all of the information surrounding their decision so that it's well documented
because that may be called into question, or that may be the sort of the key points that are made in any kind of an appeal.
Yeah, it makes sense.
All right, now let's jump right in and talk with Igor again. Igor Sikorsky III. We're so happy to have you back on the show. It's been quite a few years.
Yeah, well, thank you.
Too long.
And just for the record, Bradford Camps hasn't increased its prices this year, so we have no surcharges for extra luggage brought into camp or anything like that. So,
so this is a wonderful camp. I think it's from when I was there and not from when you were on the show, but I could be wrong. But what I recall is you saying that, you had a job in industry unrelated to what you're doing now. And you told me that there were two things that you wanted to accomplish in life. You wanted to run a sporting camp or operate a sporting camp, and you wanted to be a pilot. And you did both of them.
Yeah, that's right. It is honestly, it's a dream come true. And, the old little lessons of, follow your dreams or whatever, they stuck with me. In large part with the support of Karen, who somehow went along for the ride, because, running and owning a sporting camp is no small deal. And then, a lot of the value of the place is put into an airplane, and there's, a whole lot of, a whole lot of dedication that has to go to that as well. So, running a small business is no simple trick, and it's just takes love and dedication and hours, and but what else are we here for anyway? So
right.
It's been a really good thing.
Now there's two ways to get to the camp. You can drive on logging roads for several hours, yep. Or you can fly in, which in many respects makes a lot more sense. That's why you've got that airplane, but also to, ferry folks to different sort of fishing locations. So, you really couldn't do what you do without having an airplane at your disposal.
That's right. It's, it's right there on the front of the camps at the docks every day and ready to go. We have a lot of people who will drive in to camp for their own reasons. They've got, it's kind of an adventure on the dirt roads as well. But you're right. It's a solid 2 hours and 50 miles of dirt roads with no cell phone coverage. You're not going through any towns. There's no support or anything. You're out there. People don't realize that that's what northern Maine is like. But and then when they get there, they'll plan their next day to be a fly out to some remote pond that basically a lot of our waters are. They're inaccessible by vehicles, and maybe a mile or something hike in if you wanted to get to them some other way. But yeah, and I pick people up down in Millinocket and pick people up in Shin Pond and Presque Isle, and some people fly commercially into Presque Isle, and I can pick them up right there at Hanson Lake, and it's kind of an exotic way of having a start of your vacation, and it's pretty good scene for little old Maine.
Have you had any tricky situations flying? Anything that is sort of notable stories about flying into the lakes there in northern Maine?
To me, it's all kind of the usual stories, but every flight is different. Every flight has, you take off out of Munsungan Lake, and 20 minutes later, you arrive back and the wind has shifted. So it's a completely different approach. There's glassy water issues that are something you always have to keep in mind. There are wind conditions. Some ponds are, it's great to have a northwest breeze to come in and out of a pond. Other ponds I fly into, when we get northwest winds over 20, 25 miles an hour, the hill that's just northwest of the pond presents a real problem with downdraft. So, you have to sort of feel your way along each day and each flight. We have low weather conditions in June and September that you kind of learn to anticipate as best you can, and then you just have to work your reasonable judgment issues and you know. But occasionally, I go out in a truck and hike in and drive people out or whatever. I had some people at an outpost camp that were planning on coming out one day, and it was not flyable. So I actually drove the vehicle around, hiked in. It was 3 hours worth of work, and I hiked them in a little dinner and said, "You're staying here tonight, and I'll see you in the morning." So that's how it is up there. I mean, you can't fight it, and you have to know when you can't. That's all.
Right. You have to have respect for the fact that we're talking about the North Maine woods. And for people who are unfamiliar with that, I mean, this is really, really remote stuff. You're kind of on your own. And so you have to, rely on your skill and your experience. And, you have to think about what it is you're doing.
Yep. It's like every flight anyways, but the support circle is much smaller. So like when I leave for a flight, there is always somebody at camp that knows where I'm going and when I'm coming back. And that's part of the positive control. I don't talk to anybody, there's no Boston control, there's no Bangor, there's none of that. The positive control happens right at camp. So it's a good system. And there are also other aircraft that fly around. We're all on the same frequency. We all know each other. So, people check in when somebody's got a long flight and they know I'm in and out of water. It's always, how'd that go? Check in after I come out of a water and stuff like that. But it's a good flying community up there. It really is. It's a lot of fun. We encourage people to come visit. Anybody who's got floats and anybody who's got wheels, come into Millinocket, come into Presque Isle, and we can pick you up. It's great.
Yeah, when we went to the camp, we did the drive-in adventure. Which really was, like you say, no cell phone coverage. The GPS, the GPS maps or the GPS navigation software, I guess, at the time, didn't know anything about those roads.
Sure.
So you get the, what is it, the Maine Gazette or Gazetteer?
Yeah, the Gazetteer.
The Gazetteer.
The DeLorme Gazetteer. We call it the DeLorean. But that'll get you. But you're right. Yeah, your GPS database often will tell you to take a left, and it's telling you to drive right through the woods. It's just they're incorrect or whatever. But your cell phone won't work. So yeah, when you arrive there, we can tell what kind of person you are when you get there and you pick up your phone and you hold it up over your head and spin around a couple of times and not see any bars and. And then your reaction is either awesome or can I get online somewhere?
Yeah, when you're at camp, you're not at camp right now. We can mention that because you don't stay there during the winter months. That's not really possible.
Yeah, we go up in the winter. We do, but I do. I live down in Kittery, Maine. Karen and I live down here, nice little house, and so we have all the comforts of home that way. And then we head up in. The end of April, and we're there all the way through October, beginning of November. But we do go up in January. A bunch of guys go up with the snow machines, and we cut ice out of the lake and put it in our ice house and store it for the summer months. And we store 12 tons every year, and it goes into the coolers and into the iced tea and lemonade and cocktails, and it's a little piece of history. Bradford Camps, since 1890, has had perpetual ice there, so because of that. So, and I'll be going up in a couple of weeks, too, to do some more projects. I drive in. I can drive to within about 6 miles, and then I get the cross-country skis out, go in, and shuttle my stuff in with a snowmobile I keep there. But it's a nice scene to work there in the winter. You get a lot of work done, and nobody's there to bother you. It's a really comfortable place. You get the place warmed up and you can, do your little projects.
Yeah. Every day an adventure. It's just wonderful.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. Yeah. So, and the flying has been an enormous sort of, soul satisfaction. I feel very close in a way to my grandfather. I knew him when I was 11. That's when he died. I knew him as a young boy like that, but never like as a pilot or, professional, just as a little kid running around. But to be up there and you're flying around, you get your headsets on, but there's nobody to talk to. And you're landing on, a body of water that's not the same as ever before. And there still could be something floating there. It could be boats out in the middle. You know, everything is different. And that's the kind of flying he had to do. He's taken off and landing out of potato fields. And in rural Russia, they didn't even have airports when he began flying. It's a little bit of a kinship that I have to him when I'm doing that.
Sure. The Sikorsky weekend is basically 3 days, and you present a lot of material, information, family memorabilia, just an interesting look into the history of your grandfather. It was a nice experience for my wife and I, because it's not all day. So you have the ability to do other things during the day, as well as this benefit from this wealth of interesting history. But a lot of people don't realize, I think, that your grandfather really started out with fixed wing airplanes before figuring out the helicopter.
Yeah, that's very true. Everybody assigns his place in history to solving the helicopter problem and the helicopter riddle, which he did in 1939. But as you know, and you were there, I mean, a large part of his career and really the fascinating part of the story to me is his work in Russia. And when he's building fixed wing aircraft, he has no formal education. Nobody's told him how to design an airplane. Nobody's told him how to build an airplane. He can't even find an aircraft engine because those are not even in existence. Yet he works that riddle out. And there's so many facets, that so many decisions he had to make that were the correct ones for him at the time. For example, his first airplane was a 34-foot wingspan. It was under 1,000 pounds gross load. It's an ultralight aircraft, really. And he had two engines to install on that plane. Now, he's never designed an airplane. He's never built a plane. And he's never been in the cockpit and pushed the throttle forward, as is in 1910. And out of the two engines, one's a 15-horsepower motor, an Anzani, and one's a 25-horsepower motor. You know, any good, you know, blue-blooded airplane built, they're going to put the big engine in. Let's go. But he put the small engine in because he wanted to teach himself what flying and what handling a plane was. And it was a correct decision because, in fact, that airplane did not fly his first plane, but it did teach him how to handle a tailwheel aircraft on the ground right through the transition stage of getting the tail surface to begin to fly. And, you know, in fact, if the plane flew, he might not have lived, you know, through the flight. But he did. His first love was the helicopter, indeed. He was inspired by a dream when he was a young boy, 12 years old. And he felt himself flying in a plane or in a helicopter over an ocean, and he woke up bolt upright, and that sealed the fate of what he wanted to do with his life. And at 18 years old, dropped out of school and tried to build a couple of helicopters in 1909, which just were way before their time, and he had zero experience, but they were interesting experiences for him and learning experiences. He was fascinated by the process of discovering. The first helicopter that he designed was 600 pounds and, you know, powered by, I think it was the 25-horsepower motor, tremendously underpowered by any standards of today. But in his scaling up of power distribution, it showed promise, but he said it performed like today's helicopters remarkably. In his later life, he said it was very, very loud. It had many, it created huge clouds of dust, and it had many fascinating vibrations, which I love that phrase.
Yeah.
Fascinating vibrations. I mean, he was It wasn't a frustrating vibration, you know, it was a fascinating vibration. And that's part of a little glimpse into his mind.
Do you know how he financed the development of these early aircraft or early helicopters?
Yeah, it was a family plan. His sister and mother helped run a school for disadvantaged children in their house, and that gave the whole family a meager income. His father was a psychologist, psychiatrist of his day, actually pretty well known, but it was a middle income family. And his sister primarily loaned him the money to begin this. There's an 18-year-old kid who basically explained to his family where his heart was set and where his career was set. He dropped out of school, you know, smart guy, promising career in mathematics and sciences. And he said, you know, really what I want to do is borrow some money from you and go to Paris, which is, you know, center of aviation, but Paris is the center of a lot of things with a 18-year-old kid and a lot of money, you know.
Yeah. So,
but they entrusted their savings to him, and for a long number of years, he was in debt to his family and some other supporters, and all private capital until he had some real success with airplane number 5. So it's a couple of helicopters in the beginning, in 1908, 1909, and then went on to airplane design. And it was airplane 1, 2, 3, and 4 accumulated a total flight time of under 12 minutes, if I'm not mistaken.
Oh, so, wow.
Yeah, this is really some pretty tough learning. Aircraft 1 basically never had any flight time, and aircraft 2 had engine trouble on its maiden flight, had a retarded carburetor because, you know, everything's just rattling apart. Nothing's balanced. Handmade propeller out of one piece of wood. You know, think of all the pieces that had to go go together to make this thing go, as well as the schoolroom was the airplane. So, yeah, it went to Paris. He was at the fields of Paris where early aviation was happening. And I just imagine what kind of exciting time that was. And he describes it really well in his autobiography. He said there's groups of different people working on different aircraft of various, you know, degrees of scientific study versus imagination. And nobody really knew the right way to get an aircraft off the ground in 1908 and 1909. So the ideas got ahead of the science, often to disastrous results of, you know, loss of all family fortunes and loss of life. But he said every once in a while, a group of these designers and builders and pilots, one of them would gather around their aircraft, push it to the end of the field, and all of the other builders, people working on their own airplanes at the airfield, would stop. Everyone would drop their tools and quietly watch as this next attempt to get in the air would happen. And it most often would not. As he said, the results were rather predictable. But when they did fly, and they occasionally would, he saw many grown men just cry out of delight and seeing their dream that they're working on actually happen, you know, in front of their eyes. You know, it's quite moving.
Now, the company, Sikorsky Manufacturing Company, that was created in, 1925, I believe?
Yeah, 1924, 25. There was a couple of different corporations that came through, but the one that basically survives now was started back in 24-25 with, I think, some $5,000 in subscriptions, half of that hard currency. The result was the S-29A. He added the suffix A for America. He was delighted to be in America, being able to freely work on his designs. But indeed, it was about 5 years of trying to become an employee when he finally realized he's just going to have to keep following his dreams alone, and incorporates. And the S-29A is built on Long Island over the course of a year or so with largely volunteer labor, Russian immigrant force, as all immigrants to America, everybody clings to each other. And this was Russian immigrants and just off of Manhattan and Long Island. And they went months without pay because partly maybe they couldn't find any other work, but they were also entranced with this man who just was the type of man you wanted to follow, I think. He was just a gentle leader, and he just attracted 25 or 30 of these immigrants and stayed with him. And the descendants of those immigrants still do work at Sikorsky today.
Hmm.
Yeah, that airplane was a successful airplane after a hard beginning. It was powered by two Liberty motors that were run out, World War I motors. But they collected scrap from the dump to put this airplane together. They had one day when the hospital changed all their bed frames out and threw their old bed frames into the dump. And then the Sikorsky team of 20-some-odd immigrants dove on the dump to go dump picking, and they actually redesigned the fuselage around what they were able to scavenge from these steel bed frames. That turned out to be a very successful plane. It was the first commercial plane that could fly on one engine, first two-engine commercial aircraft that could fly on one engine to maintain flight. It didn't need both. It needed both to get in the air, likely, on a full load, but would maintain altitude on one. And so a little bit of an idea of the kind of success and the kind of intuition that led Igor and his team, intuition from his team to that success. But it was a shoestring budget.
Hmm. A few years after the formation of the company, it became part of what would ultimately become United Technologies Corporation.
That's right. And so there was a series of one-off planes. The S-29 was a one-off plane. the S-30, 31, 32. I think one of them wasn't even built. It was a design, but all the way up to an S-34, which was his first amphib plane. They were all one-off planes. And if you know anything about manufacturing, you don't make any money on the first one or two or three or four. You need production line. So this was a hand-to-mouth company that, they literally picking up rivets that fell on the ground outside the hangar to keep the airplane going. And they were fighting the chickens for the rivets, too. The chickens were eating rivets for digestive purposes.
Oh, no.
And the story goes, in the end, the workers won because they got the rivets anyway.
Oh,
but, yeah. And so in 1928, again, intuition comes into play here because Igor and his team, they landed on the idea that amphibian water landing and land-based aircraft are going to be the beginning of real commercial aviation. And America is the right place for it. It's a big country. It will benefit greatly from air flight and commercial flight. And so they landed on this design, the S-38. And I don't know how, but somehow indeed they scraped together enough money to not produce one. But they had enough faith in the design, they built 10 in the beginning. They were powered by two Pratt & Whitney engines. So it was a twin engine, 550 horsepower each. And they were very capable of flying pilot and co-pilot and six passengers off of water, off of land, off of rough fields. A 400-mile range, very respectable in those days, 100-mile-an-hour flight airspeed. So it was, in 1928, it was top of the line. And that first run of 10 sold out immediately. And indeed, as you said, Max, they that was basically the beginning of the knock on the door from United Aircraft saying, you know, you need us and we want you. And my grandfather was one of the happiest days of his life when United Aircraft, you know, requested he come on board. And I'll add this one part of his personality was that he said, you know, two provisions. One, you just metaphorically take that file cabinet of all the debts that I owe people. Please take that with you. And you take care of that, and I will be your man for my whole career, a normal engineer salary. But he said, also, you have to bring my team with me. I can't work without my team. And that's a feeling I think even survives to this day, that team of 28 or so individuals who were so dedicated, worked so long and weren't paid and often, and they, as I said before, that their descendants are still there at Sikorsky. I know it.
Well, one impression I have is that many times when something larger absorbs something smaller, that the culture of the smaller entity kind of becomes, you know, lost as it sort of infuses into the larger organization. But I have this sense that that didn't quite happen with Sikorsky and United, well, United Aircraft first, and then later United, United Technologies, and maybe a sort of a indicator of that is the way that your grandfather's office was preserved at the company, right? They, when he was gone, they didn't just disassemble the office and, you know, pitch everything. It was preserved.
That's right, and it's still there, and it's not quite open to the public. It's open to, I don't know, almost anybody by appointment. It's open to almost anybody by appointment, I guess. In fact, the heirs of Igor Sikorsky, of which I'm one, are the true owners of the office. But you know, that's the office is going to stay there. And the other neat thing about that office is it's, you know, this big corporation in the 30s and 40s, as it's growing, they had vice presidents and presidents, and you know, the forward end of the building is where administration was and where managers were and all that. Well, my grandfather wanted his office to be centered in the engineering department, and he wanted, you know, to get to his office. And I remember as a little boy walking into his office, which he kept and went to 5 days a week anyway, 6 days a week up until the day he died. But I remember walking through the drafting rooms to get to his office. And I think that was a little bit of an idea of what type of man he was. He wanted to be, he's a nuts and bolts guy, but like I said, a gentle leader. I hear more than once I've heard stories of him maybe watching a draftsman at work, and he would watch quietly from a distance. I can only imagine the sweat pouring off the drafter's forehead, wondering, the big man's looking at me.
Yeah.
But and then in the end, he would say something like, you are doing such fine work. Your understanding of the situation is so perfect. The stresses of you know, whatever you're looking at, you have a very good handle on how you're designing this part. It's interesting that you've chosen out of the three different ways of doing this, one way of doing it this way, one way of doing this way, and you chose this third way, and that's a great solution, and then leave. Basically planting the seed with the draftsman of actually the correct way of doing it, and realizing that he had not been heading in the perfect solution, but just getting a gentle nudge.
Well, then, of course, in 2015, United Technologies sold Sikorsky to Lockheed Martin for $9 billion. What do you think your grandfather would think about that?
I think that he was an accepting man. He thought of United Aircraft as his parent company, and he worked for them and was a dedicated United Air. But if that's the way that, you know, Tower of Power wanted to play that game, I think that would have been fine with him as long as the end result was a betterment of product and the ability to freely engineer the right solution. That's where his head was. He was dedicated. You know, it was a shakeup just in the sort of community of Sikorsky to think that, you know, the beloved United Technologies, United Aviation, United Aircraft was no longer going to be the company. But I think he would have a more holistic approach and accept it. And, you know, his dedication was to the engineering as long as that part was preserved. And I believe that it is. You know, it was just probably a better place for the company to be under Lockheed Martin. Maybe that's how they figured it. And I really don't know. But it seems to be a good move for all I hear from Sikorsky is everybody's very satisfied.
Oh, that's good. That's great.
Yeah.
Kind of a fun item, in a little different vein. And I wasn't aware of this, but I think you brought it up, Igor, that there is this Two Roads Brewing Company that is apparently in Stratford, Connecticut, where, of course, Sikorsky is, and not all that far from me, maybe an hour from me. And they have a Russian Imperial Stout limited edition, honoring your grandfather.
It's a funny thing. It's a great beer, for starters. It's a really interesting and a large brewery of very dedicated people. They do a lot of contract brewing for other successful beer ventures out there that can't keep up with their own growth. But they make a mean Russian Imperial Stout. It's a 12% beer, 11.5%.
Oh, wow.
And yeah, no, it's not beer. It's, you know, you sit down and, you know, you think about it. But but it is in Stratford. It's right there off the highway. It's actually right kitty corner from my grandfather's Russian Orthodox Church, where he was, we helped start the church and was buried or had his funeral there. I remember that. And it's an old mill building there and owned by Brad Hiddle and a bunch of his friends or a few of his friends. But this is a big operation. And so, yes, every year they do, like I said, 1,000 bottles. The line is out the door and they sell out. And the Sikorsky family is invited to be there on hand to sign bottles and talk to people about the history. So I'm invited on. My dad is sometimes there. My uncle Sergey and Nikolai have been there. I have a cousin Lisa Winters, who's also granddaughter to Igor. She was there this year. And the line doesn't stop at once they get their bottles. They, by and large, everybody walks through the line to have me sign their beer. I didn't have much to do with the beer, but I'm honored to be a part of it. And like I said, it's good product. And they do, of course, they have a whole different selection of beer and a giant 1,000-person tasting room and really nice guys. They do a fun thing and they honor Stratford with their, you know, with this day. They honor the people of Stratford, the people that worked at Sikorsky. It's that type of thing. It seems to be a giving back as much as it is, you know, here's some good beer and a great name and let's put it together. But it's Two Roads Brewing and Brewing Company. And the beer that they put on is called The Road Less Traveled. Aha. Uh-huh. And Igor's dream is the Road Less Traveled series. And it's
nice.
Russian. It's aged in rye barrels, rye whiskey barrels. And
I'm getting thirsty. I want.
Oh, yeah, David, I was just going to say,
my bottle right now. So
I was going to say, how do we get on the list to actually get some?
Well, you can just, you know, I guess keep inviting me back to your show.
That's easy.
Maybe I'll find an extra bottle for you. You can always get in line. I talked to one guy, one of the earlier guys in line for MetaSign. His record was getting in line at 2 o'clock in the morning.
Wow.
Yeah. So, you know, it's like, you know, it's like concert tickets, you know.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, the line's out the door. There's, you know, food vendors and, you know, it's a fun day. It's a kind of just a celebration day. Yeah.
I don't know how I went all these years living so close and hadn't heard about this until just now.
Because you're always in Pennsylvania and never in Connecticut.
Well, it seems that way.
Next year, I'm giving you guys a heads up.
Yeah, and please do.
I'll give you a fair
please
warning.
Please do.
And,
and I'll be there.
Somehow find a way to get you around the line, maybe.
Yeah.
But the line is fun, too. It's all fun people. And one guy I talked to, he, you know, waiting in line for 2 hours for me to sign a bottle and my uncle's. But he shook my hand. When he shook my hand, he said, my grandfather was the first night watchman at Sikorsky, and he rode a horse.
Wow. So,
and he said it with like pride, like everybody there is half the people at least work for Sikorsky or know somebody or family members. Yeah, yeah. And there's a real, it shows, it's a real pride. It's solid. Yeah.
Now we want to just close out in a few minutes with some more information about the Sikorsky weekend, because I know our listeners are going to be interested in some of the details of that. But first, another connection, of course, Max Trescott is a big Cirrus guy. He also likes the airplanes. You're going to have a bunch of Cirrus pilots coming to the camp or stopping at the camp on some kind of an adventure that they're on.
Exactly. Yeah, this was a total whim that had happened. I was at Pease Air Force Base and looking at doing some maybe some rotary time. They've got a couple of helicopters there, but maybe just bumping up my ratings. And mostly I never drop, you know, the Igor name. I fly undercover often. But at an airport, it just seemed like the right time, and I introduced myself as Igor Sikorsky, and it, you know, two other people sort of joined in the hangar talk with what we're doing, and one of them is a Cirrus member, and he's a member of the Cirrus Owners and Pilots Association, and he said, you know, we do a little thing every year, a couple times a year. There's a couple thousand of us that own Cirrus or parts of Cirruses, and everybody's looking for a place to take them. So why don't we come up to your place? And I said, sure, you know, that might happen. And indeed it is. There are, I don't know, 16 people, 17 people coming, basically filling the camps. They're going to start wherever they start, and they land in Rockland. They're going to go to the Owl's Head Museum in Rockland and then fly up to Millinocket. And we're going to shuttle them in a couple different flights in my plane and the 206 with Katahdin Air that we work together. And from there, they go to Halifax. And then from there, they're going to go to Quebec City. And that just a guys, girls with planes having a ball. And so, yeah, it's Peter Storer, who is the fellow who is putting it all together. I think if you're a Cirrus Owners and Pilots Association member, you probably already know about this one. It was kind of a no-brainer for him. And it looks like a lot of fun.
Yeah, that'll be fun. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. So that's happening in, I don't know when that's happening.
It's in September, isn't it?
Yeah, I've got the dates right here. The entire trip, September 21st through the 30th, and that includes a couple of days at the Bradford camps.
That's correct. Yep, that's right. You got it. Exactly. Good job. Yeah. So that's a fun thing. So we have a bird watching weekend. We have the Sikorsky thing. This one's crazy, but we have a knitters weekend.
Oh, I believe that. I absolutely believe that.
And it's, you know, you'd think, oh, that'll be great. You know, the wife can come up with her knitting and the guy can go fishing. Well, no fishermen are allowed. You have to be a knitter. You can't, no guests, no tag-alongs. You can be a guy and be a knitter, but you have to be a knitter. And they're coming up to knit, but to teach them map and compass. We teach them how to fly fish. We, you know, just show them our world up there. It's a pretty cool thing too. So, you know, I don't know, broadening out the offering, not just the normal hook and bullet thing up there. Yeah.
Okay. When do I get my money in for Sikorsky weekend?
You want to? Why don't you give me your credit card over the phone here? And
yeah.
I'm about one step away from that, Igor. Just so you know,
Well, thank you. Yeah, it's good. It's good. We have Aerospatial coming in, if all goes well. That's a real wild card. Rotary guys talk big talk, but I'm just kidding. There's so many pieces of that puzzle. But we do have a 206 coming in, 185, and we have a supercharged Cub coming in. And then a few people that are driving in, or I'm going to fly them in, or whatever. We have a pretty good crowd coming already, but still some space left. So
yeah, I was just going to ask, how many spots are still available?
Well, we have it depends on. We have different size cabins at camp. We have cabins to sleep 2, 4, and 6 people. So it starts. You know, if we have a bunch of couples come up, then I try and get everybody into their own cabin and not do shared cabins. That just is not how we want to do it. Essentially one cabin left, but it's a big cabin. So bring a lot of people.
Yeah, we should say this is July 6, 7, and 8, 2018. And you get obviously lodging and meals. I remember the food is outstanding. I don't know how you and Karen are able to create such delicious food.
Well, we have a great staff. I don't know. I guess we treat them pretty well. But Tiffany up there, Tiffany Craig, her family's even from that area, but she's from Portland, and she's just she just likes what she does, and that's a good place to start. And then we got a guy working for us, Chad Rozelle. He's actually worked for us his first job out of high school, and that was 23 years ago. So he's wow. Part of the
family. He's still there.
Yeah. So the food is great, and it's just a beautiful atmosphere, and it's, you know, a bunch of people who are interested in history of aviation. That, you know, my grandfather's life was can be looked under a microscope, or it can be looked under the broad spectrum of aviation. To be born in, you know, 14 years before the Wright brothers flew, and he met Neil Armstrong after he walked on the moon. Just an amazing piece of history, and he was a big part of it.
Well, Igor, the website is bradfordcamps.com. We'll have a link to that in the show notes, of course. But Igor, let me just give you an opportunity to kind of describe in your own words, because I've done it on your behalf many times, but in your own words, what the Sikorsky weekend is like. What can people expect to find and to go away with?
Yep. It's a 3-day or a 2-night affair, although a lot of people choose to come in earlier or stay later or whatever. But you are coming into a traditional log cabin sporting lodge where there's a series of separate cabins and the main lodge, and you have your own cabin, full bathroom. It's comfortable. They're cleaned every day and beds are made. It's a kind of an elegant woodsy place. And again, all the meals are done, and then you get me and a slideshow talking about history and how my grandfather fits in history in general from World War I through the Cold War and his aviation careers. And then there's kind of a lot of, as you said before, a lot of sort of hang time to sit on the porch and, you know, look at the lake. There's nobody else on 12 miles of shoreline. It's really quite pristine. And there's hiking trails and kayaks and jump in the lake and go swimming. We can pick you up and fly you in out of Millinocket or Bangor or anywhere. Or you can do what you did, Max, and ride the road in.
Yeah.
See some moose.
Yes.
We take good care of you. And seems to be, we get some regular guests that like to come again and again. My cousin this year will be coming with her husband, Lisa Winters, who's a granddaughter to Igor also, and a cousin that I don't know very well. I'm very, very excited to have her there and her son. So we're having myself, grandson, and a granddaughter, and a great-grandson at Bradford Camps of Igor. So it'll be a neat one this year.
It's going to be a blast.
Well, thank you. I appreciate all that. And as you can tell, all you have to do is call me and I'll talk about Sikorsky stuff on the air, off the air. I enjoy it. It's a great story. I'm blessed to have a great story to tell that's not even my own, but it partly is. And yeah, it's been a joy to be a part of that history.
Now Pete Combs tells us about the latest episode of AIN's The Human Factor, Tales from the Flight Deck.
Hi, geeks. I've just finished putting together episode 11 of AIN's Human Factor, Tales from the Flight Deck. This one's about the advent of a completely new way to figure out if it's safe to land at your destination airport when the runway is contaminated with water, slush, snow, or ice. You know, this has been a problem for just about as long as people have been flying, and there have been a number of solutions. Chet Collette is director of flight operations at Alaska Airlines. He says one of the first means of measuring braking action on a contaminated runway was called the Cocker Spaniel test.
The airport operator would have his Cocker Spaniel on the seat next to him in his truck, and he would go down the runway at about 30 miles an hour, and he'd slam on the brakes. And if the Cocker Spaniel stayed on the seat, then the braking action was poor. If the Cocker Spaniel started to fall off the seat but still stayed on the seat, then the braking action was fair. If the Cocker Spaniel went onto the floor, then the braking action was good.
Now, I promise, no Cocker Spaniels were harmed in the making of this podcast. But you can see that initially gauging an aircraft's braking ability on a wet or icy runway wasn't very scientific. The problem came to a head in 2005 when a Southwest Airlines 737-700 ran off the end of the runway at Chicago's Midway Airport, blasting through a couple of fences and onto Central Avenue near 55th. The aircraft hit two cars, killing a 6-year-old boy in one of them. Well, that was the beginning of what is now known as the Takeoff and Landing Performance Assessment Initiative, TALPA. The idea is a bold one, measuring braking action on a slick runway before landing and deciding whether it's safe for your aircraft. Check it out, Episode 11 of AIN's Human Factor, Tales from the Flight Deck. You'll find it at AINonline.com/humanfactor. Thanks, Max. Thanks, guys. We'll see you at the airport.
Now we have a history segment, an airplane of the week from David. Now, David, I'll let you tee this up, but I've got to give you a lot of credit for picking this particular aircraft for this particular episode.
Yeah, this is probably the stupidest thing I've ever done in my life. Only once have I will say this before I start. Only once have I ever been this nervous about an interview or a history segment. And Igor, to be honest, you're in good company. The last person I was this nervous about was Senator John Glenn.
Wow.
So I'm terrified of this. So
you meet me down at Two Roads Brewing next year. And all of that will evaporate.
There you go.
Heartbeat. You're good to go.
So in honor of our guest this evening, and I've let him down before on history segments, the last two times he's been on, I told him I should have done a Sikorsky segment, and I didn't. Well, this year, I'm going to. And we're going to talk about the VS-300, the very first practical helicopter in the United States. First flown by Igor Sikorsky himself on September 14th, 1939, tethered. Igor was always interested in vertical flight, and the VS-300 was not his first helicopter. His first was not a success, powered by a 25-horsepower Anzani engine, and would not even take off the ground. The following year, in 1910, the S-2 did fly, but wasn't able to lift a person. Both the S-1 and S-2 had counter-rotating rotors, not what a conventional Sikorsky layout would be known for. With the failure of the S-2, Igor went to work on fixed-wing aircraft and received its pilot's license in France. During this time, Igor's most successful aircraft was the four-engine airliner that became a bomber, the Ilya Murmansk. It was the world's first dedicated strategic bomber for the Imperial Russian Air Service. With the onset of the Russian Revolution, Igor immigrated to the United States on March 30, 1919. In 1923, after being a lecturer, Sikorsky opened up the Sikorsky Manufacturing Company to produce the S-29A, a 16-place airliner. The A, as Igor said earlier, stealing my thunder, stood for America. The S-29 failed to sell, but in a bit of irony, it was the Gotha bomber in Howard Hughes' masterpiece, Hell's Angels, where it crashed and was never rebuilt. Igor became a citizen of the United States in 1928. He moved his company from New York to Stratford, Connecticut. In 1929, United Aircraft and Transport Corporation purchased the company to produce the S-42 Clipper for Pan American Airways. But vertical lift was never far from Igor's mind. He continued to file patents for direct lift aircraft, and on March 19, 1935, the U.S. Patent Office awarded number 1,994,488 for another direct lift aircraft. This patent would actually become the VS-300. The S-42 was given the VS-300 name because it was part of Voigt Sikorsky. The VS-300 had a 75-horsepower engine and had weights hung off its framework during its first tethered flight. After its first tethered flight on September 14, 1939, the main rotor had a full cyclic control and an enclosed boom with an anti-torque tail rotor. The cyclic control wasn't satisfactory, so Igor made changes. On May 13, 1940, Sikorsky made the first free flight. The major change was the framework was no longer enclosed and was open tube work. The tail rotor area was also redesigned. The anti-torque rotor was supplemented by vertical rotors on outriggers. These were believed to provide better lateral control. The VS-300 was a true experimental ship. It was changed over time. Eventually, the outriggers were replaced with taller horizontal rotor to assist with the anti-torque rotor. That was eliminated when the main rotor cyclic control was perfected by Sikorsky. The VS-300 was, in April of 1941, fitted with pneumatic flotation bags, otherwise known as pontoons, and became the first helicopter to take off and land on water. Besides the pontoons, various landing gears were tried and skids. The VS-300 was in its final form was a single fabric-covered fuselage with 150-horsepower Franklin engine with a three-bladed main rotor. It had a single nose wheel and two main wheels midship. One of the most unique features of the aircraft was its luggage system. A bicycle basket was placed on the front of the nose. I've always liked this picture since I was a little kid reading about helicopters in my Time Life book. I will put it in the show notes for Igor in his traditional fedora hovering the VS-300 while someone's loading the basket with a box. I defer to Igor the First for describing this. During several flights, it was possible to approach with the helicopter in plain flight a man standing on top of a pile of rocks or on another place and enable him, without moving from his place, to load or unload a suitcase onto the machine. On this flight, it was necessary to approach the man and, after the suitcase was loaded, to move directly backward. Most of these flights were purposely made over such places where the helicopter could not be landed. The completely satisfactory control of the machine, which permitted to approach a person hover for substantial periods within a loss than 2 feet from the desired place, was therefore positively demonstrated. It may therefore be considered as definitely proven that a helicopter with a control of such type will successfully solve all control problems connected with operating an aircraft from congested places between buildings or trees, and will permit landing on platforms situated on buildings or board ships, etc. There can be no doubt that such an aircraft of such characteristics will open up an important, large, now field of air travel. Kind of an understatement of the universe, the just because you could put a suitcase in the front of a helicopter, it was going to change the world. And one of Igor's biggest dreams was helicopters saving people. And the VS-300 effectively flew and was retired to the Ford Museum of Dearborn, Michigan, where it's probably the most, at the time, was probably the most practical helicopter, and still exists at the museum. The VS-316 was the follow-on, and that flew on February 13, 1942. The R-4, as it was known in the United States Army Air Forces, would go on to become the first helicopter to medically evacuate a soldier. The VS-300 was the beginning of a long line of Sikorsky helicopters that currently is the future is the S-97 Raider, which ironically is a coaxial helicopter, the rotor system that was so unsuccessful in the S-1, S-2. And with that, this is a nervous wreck David M. Vanderhoof signing off.
All right, David.
David, that was great. You are amazing. You caught it all.
Very good. Nice. Nicely done.
Okay, I can breathe now.
Yes, you can breathe now.
Yeah, no corrections, no horrible discrepancies, and well presented. And I mean, it's hard to get it out there in one breath, isn't it?
Igor, are there any flying examples of some of these early aircraft still around?
The Russian aircraft or, none of the Russian, there are models, but the oldest flying Sikorsky is Kermit Weeks has it now, I think, and it's an S-39, which was the smaller version of the S-38, the first successful Sikorsky design in America. Yeah, really radical design. If you've ever seen a picture, you'll probably come back to mind when I describe it to you. It's what they call a parasol wing. There's nothing else attached to it. And then a bunch of struts below that from which hang the engine. And the S-39 was a single engine, and the S-38 was a twin engine. And then below that, hung by struts and wires, is the fuselage. And way out back is the empennage, spread away by booms away from the wing. It's a ungainly looking aircraft that flew very, very well. But yeah, so that's the oldest. The VS-300, of course, is not flying anymore, but well displayed at Ford. There is some reproduction S-38. I think Kermit Weeks has an S-42. That he is rebuilding. The S-44, the largest and last aircraft or airplane of my grandfather's down at the New England Air Museum.
It's around the corner from Max.
That's right.
That plane is incredible. I had the distinct pleasure of being able to sit in the pilot seat of that aircraft and feel the pedals and feel the yoke. I didn't move anything, of course, but I slung my elbow out the window, and apparently somebody let the crowd know that Igor Sikorsky was inside the aircraft, and the paparazzi went mad.
I bet.
It was fun. It's been an honor to be a part of it. But that's a great museum, New England Air Museum. They do a wonderful job. And if I may, the Igor I. Sikorsky Historical Archives is it's not really a museum. It's an archive. It's basically where all the paperwork and all the drawings and all the videos and old just the archival data of Sikorsky they don't need it anymore. It's going to be discarded. Well, it's getting curated there at the Sikorsky Archives, a friendly group of retired Sikorsky guys that are keeping the history going. And when you have a picture of a Sikorsky airplane that's got a couple people standing around outside, you can send it to them, and a good chance that somebody there is going to know who that was. Just neat stuff.
Great. And that's at SikorskyArchives.com, I think.
Igor I. Sikorsky Historical Archives will get you there. It's $25 a year or something for a. They do four really nice color mailings every year of multiple pages of a particular topic. They're a very dedicated and creative and good group of guys. So maybe at some point they'll have more of a museum quality to them if they head in that direction. But they're gaining some floor space now. Lockheed Martin has bumped up their little stipend that will give them a lot more square footage, a lot more comfortable place to house and display and share. Their stuff's right outside of Sikorsky. You go across the bridge on the Housatonic and you see the plant. And when you see that, you're looking at the archives. They're right there also.
Good. Okay. All right. Now a little bit of what's up with the geeks. Just wanted to mention, I recently listened to Peter Johnson's extended podcast, episode 79. And a couple of interesting connections back here. The episode includes an interview with a journalist who authored the book Computer Crashes When Airplane Systems Fail. And it turns out this author interviewed our guest from last week, Bill Palmer, for the book on the issues of automation. But Peter says that he's actually read the book. And it was so interesting to him that he read the whole thing through in one sitting. So it's an interesting story, again, by a journalist who's not an aviation guy, but who learned a lot about aviation along the way. That's in extended episode 79. But also in that episode, Peter speaks with Vincent Aiello, from the Fighter Pilot podcast. And if that sounds familiar, that's because we mentioned the Fighter Pilot podcast a couple of episodes ago. And it's all about being a U.S. Navy aviator flying the F-18 Hornet. And each episode of that podcast focuses in on kind of one aspect to it. There was an episode about ejection seats. There was another episode, a really interesting episode, about the effects of high Gs on the human body and how the pilots, you know, respond to that kind of a situation. So we'll have links to those in the show notes, of course, Aviation Extended, episode 79, and also the Fighter Pilot podcast. All right, Brian, been doing anything interesting?
Yeah, over the weekend, I was up at Camarillo and randomly stumbled across, it seemed like a World War II fly-in. And the only aircraft that I could actually identify was a B-25. And having that aircraft land at the airport was certainly unusual. I've been there before and I've never seen a bomber fly in. So that was that was kind of fun. There were some other World War II era aircraft, but I couldn't identify them. And I wasn't in a very good spot to get any pictures. I did take a picture of the bomber, and if we could put it in the show notes, that'd be great. But again, it's just not a good picture because I just wasn't in the right spot for it. But it was fun for President's Day weekend to see a bunch of World War II aircraft.
Yeah, what a surprise. Yeah, it's fun, you know, over the years to sort of accumulate your ability to identify different aircraft. I mean, I think we all start with kind of limited skills in that area, but if you pay attention and maybe do a little bit of research from time to time, you sort of accumulate the knowledge, and whether it's modern era aircraft, commercial or military, or old historic aircraft, I've certainly am able to identify many airplanes today that I couldn't even a few years ago, or 5 years ago, or 10 years ago. It's always fun.
And that's why I thought you kept me around.
Yeah, well, you've helped with that, certainly, David. Thank you. All right, on to a little bit of the listener mail. Boy, you know, we get a lot of listener mail, and we read it all. Some of it we respond to. We try to respond to a lot of it, but it's just not possible. And only a few items do we have enough time to mention on the show, but we've got a couple. We heard from Tim, who sent us an article, Imperial Notifies Transport Canada of Potential Aviation Fuel Quality Issue. Now, Imperial is a large Canadian refiner, and they've notified regulators and customers that there's a potential fuel quality problem with some of their avgas, 100 low lead, shipped from a certain refinery. And they're worried that the fuel could cause interference with onboard fuel gauge sensors on aircraft that uses avgas. So as soon as they found this, they stopped shipments, obviously. Imperial's asking that the distributors stop distributing that product. Max Trescott, have you ever run across anything like that before? I would think the implications of this could be pretty huge.
Oh, definitely they are. In fact, I was trying to figure out how fuel could interfere with the fuel gauge sensors.
Yeah.
I think most of these are float sensors, and I don't know if there was something about the composition of the fuel that was eating away at the float, perhaps. I mean, that was about the only thing I could think of. But there was an incident here in Northern California, it's probably been 20 years ago, in which I believe some avgas fuel at a couple of different airports here was contaminated with jet fuel. And so I can't remember, I think it was Chevron. And they ended up buying probably on the order of about 75 new engines for various aircraft owners that could prove that they bought tainted fuel. Because jet fuel in an avgas engine is almost an instant death sentence for that engine.
Yes. Yeah, that doesn't work very well at all. Well, let's see. We heard from Papa Fox 80. And this is an article he sent us from the Aviation Herald about an accident. It uses the word accident in the headline, but it's not really an accident, I don't think. But the balance of the headline is Spirit A20N near Fort Lauderdale on January 28th, 2018. Fumes on board, crew feeling increasingly incapacitated. So this was about a Spirit Airlines, an Airbus A320. And en route at flight level 380, about an hour before landing, the passenger began to complain about a smell. And then the cabin crew confirmed some strange smell. It became stronger and stronger. It says until the cabin air became nearly, quote, not breathable. Flight crew was informed. ATC was informed about fumes on board. They descended the aircraft. Finally, the flight crew put on their oxygen masks. It got so bad. Flight attendants felt nauseous. A number said that they nearly passed out. The captain depressurized the aircraft below 10,000 feet, and then it landed at Fort Lauderdale. It says emergency services needed to treat flight and cabin crew still on board of the aircraft. All cabin crew and flight crew were taken to hospitals. Now, some of this information in this article seems to be kind of inconsistent from my reading, but the Aviation Herald first got information that said that Spirit Airlines incurred a severe full engine wet seal breach fume event. The captain was nearly incapacitated on landing, was quick to don emergency cockpit oxygen. Subsequent research found that there were seriously increased levels of carbon monoxide with all members of the cabin crew. Several flight attendants reached levels near lethal values. Also, one flight attendant suffered a heart condition, and which currently cannot be ruled out to become chronic. Another flight attendant suffered from disorientation, migraine, loss of memory. The flight attendants were kept in the hospital for some time and then were released into home care, but some of them still feel ill. And it kind of goes on and on. The FAA was notified 2 hours after this event. At that time, the NTSB had not been notified, but the FAA then said they were investigating. Finally, the NTSB said they were looking into it and said, quote, Code of Federal Regulations 830.5 requires NTSB to be notified when a required crew member, flight or cabin, cannot complete their official duties. NTSB investigators contacted Spirit Airlines and were briefed on the circumstances that occurred on this flight. All crew members completed their official duties throughout the flight. Several flight attendants were transported to the hospital, but none were admitted. The pilots did not go to the hospital. No further investigation is planned. Earlier, it mentioned the engine problem, and it notes the wet seals were found breached. It says on the PW1127G. Now, that's the geared turbofan engine, the Pratt engine. But subsequently, the FAA reported that it was an APU problem, that they thought that the oil had been overfilled, and that allowed it to get into the ventilation system, causing all of these problems. So a big kind of a nightmare. I guess the one of the observations from our listener here was some of the time that elapsed between the occurrence and taking some action. He also says there's no mention of the passengers, although there are reasons that bad air would affect cabin crew more than passengers, both per instance and over time. So really kind of a bizarre situation. This is the kind of thing that you really don't want to encounter in a flight. But the health risks are really clear in this case. What's not clear is what the effects are on the folks on that airplane and what's going to happen next.
Yeah, I think this is yet another example of human error. I mean, if you look at all kinds of incidents and accidents, it seems like a high percentage of them are human error, people making mistakes. So, you know, there it goes again.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. And, coming from a former engine manufacturer, you know, my credibility might be, you know, kind of limited on this. But as you say, I think more often than not, it's a human error rather than a design error or a product error. Although you can argue that if it's possible to, in this case, let's just say it does turn out to be an overfilling of the APU oil, if it is possible to overfill the oil, then maybe the design isn't good. A better design would be one where it's not possible to, you know, to overfill it.
Sure. Or better labeling.
Yeah, something. But this is quite a story. And I think there's probably more to come on this. So we'll try to stay up with it and see where that goes. And then JD wrote to us. He said, thanks for the time and effort you put into the podcast each week. I'm listening to episode 490 now and the comments you guys are making about military aircraft and ADS-B out. It has been a problem for a while that military aircraft have been broadcasting ADS-B out information, as the GAO report reveals. It seems like we are in a hurry to modify and comply with the FAA 2020 mandate without providing a solution to turn the broadcast off when required. And then he notes that, you know, it's easy. All you need is a Raspberry Pi, an antenna, an internet connection, some freeware software, and you can capture and broadcast ADS-B data. Also, that the data obtained from the ADS-B out aircraft is a comprehensive set of variables required to employ kinetic and non-kinetic threats against the aircraft. It says, additionally, someone can easily correlate information from multiple open source databases, like the FAA registry, plane spotter photos, and open social media profiles of military members and civilian contractors to build a pattern of life profiles. This is all bad for OPSEC and personal security. And then there's a link to an article from the Aviationist. Air Force Special Ops plane carrying U.S. commandos makes, quote, surprise, unquote, landing in Libya. This was about a C-146A operated by the 524th Special Operations Squadron of the 27th Special Operations Wing, U.S. Air Force Special Operations Command. They landed at an air base in Tripoli, or near Tripoli. He said, interestingly, the article says, interestingly, the aircraft carried a team of armed people wearing civilian clothes. According to some sources, they landed without any coordination with the local authorities, and that's why they were asked to leave. Although it was later confirmed they were U.S. Special Ops Forces, the reason of their trip to Libya is yet to be explained. But then J.D. finishes, the problem with the installed equipment on military aircraft is that on some military aircraft, the ADS-B out broadcast doesn't have an off switch like traditional military IFF transponders. He says, I know of one military aircraft undergoing modification to provide an off switch for the ADS-B feed to terminate the broadcast during due regard operations, flight into sensitive areas, and to comply with theater spins, SPINS. This modification is just a few years too late. So for want of an off switch is the message there. Mark Newton sent us a link to a... Oh, this is a strange story. Igor, here's another helicopter connection. Leaping Elk crashes low-flying research helicopter in Utah. This from AP News. So there's this research helicopter. It was trying to capture an elk. I'm not sure how a helicopter captures an elk exactly. But the elk jumped onto the helicopter's tail rotor. The helicopter was only about 10 feet above ground. I see. The crew was trying to drop a net on the elk. That's how a helicopter catches an elk. The elk didn't do so well, died of its injuries. There were two people on board, but they weren't seriously hurt. Probably a fairly unusual occurrence to have a helicopter downed by an elk.
And I remember a story, I went and researched it back in 2007. A moose brought down a helicopter up in Alaska.
Oh,
and
really?
It was a similar kind of situation where they had were trying to capture the moose. They had used a dart gun, and as it was getting groggy at one point, it went toward the helicopter and went into the rear rotor blade, which brought that helicopter down as well.
Wow.
I could throw a little bit into that if you guys still have me there.
Yes.
So we had a guest, Al Averill, who was one of the first commercial helicopter pilots in Maine. He used to do crop dusting and stuff back in the early 50s or something, way early. But yeah, another thing he did was work for the Department of Fisheries, and he was in charge of flying the helicopter when they would collar moose. And they would actually use a helicopter to corral a moose into water. And moose are really good swimmers. So when the moose is completely like over its head and swimming, then and they even have a Mutual of Omaha Wild Kingdom. They have this episode with Al Averill at the controls, and Jim is hanging on the skids, wrapping a collar around a moose's neck. In flight, and there's no jumping on a rotor when a moose is swimming in the water up to its ears,
Right. Yes.
So it actually looks like the right way. A lot of good clearance, and and a moose in some sort of control, and all you have to do is keep your altitude. And I don't know, it's a neat little story. But wow, they're lucky they got away from that. You lose a rotor in flight, and you don't have many options quick.
That's right. That's right.
Or a tail rotor, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, probably being just 10 feet up probably is what saved them. Of course, they've been much higher up. I don't think the elk could have jumped in, but
And
having been in Maine on High Adventure and Scouts, moose are mean. We were paddling down the river and there was a baby moose that my two of my scout cohorts decided they'd go up close to. They almost got taken out in the canoe because they couldn't paddle fast enough to get away from mom, who showed up from around the corner.
There you go. Sure, I believe that.
I have full respect for moose. They're quite capable, moving very large in very large water.
Yeah, they're the most dangerous animal in the woods, far surpassing a bear. The moose are what you want to worry about. Yep, no question.
Once, my moose story is wife and I and some others hiking up in the Mount Katahdin area in Maine.
Yay.
And yeah, beautiful. Just, oh, what a great hike that was. That's when I had enough youth in me to be able to do things like that. But we were at sort of a base camp, and there were actually a couple of outhouses. And I was in one, my wife was in the other, and, you know, I finished, and I opened up the door, and there was a mother moose and and two babies. And we were kind of between the mother and the babies, and she didn't know we were in these outhouses. So we had to hole up, because, that, I mean, you don't want to get between you know, a mother and you know, and her baby, you know, in almost any kind of a creature, but in the case of a moose, you definitely don't want to, you know, present a threat like that. So that's my moose story.
Good thing for the outhouse for a few reasons, probably.
Yes, I know.
Well, and anybody who's seen the commercial for whatever it is, where the moose takes out the swing set in the RV, that's just not even close to what they are like in real life. welcome to This Week in Airplane Geeks Moose Stories.
Yes. All right. Well, we do have one last bit of listener mail we wanted to mention, and it's from our friend Mick, who sent us an item, North Korea Military Parade 2018, Best Moments. Now, this is your standard North Korean military parade, but if you jump ahead to the three-minute mark, and we'll put this in the show notes, you'll be able to watch this video, there is an aerial demonstration. Now, this is the... this parade is commemorating the North Korean Army's 70th anniversary. So what you see up in the sky are some airplanes. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 planes making a 7. They're flying as like a flying 7. And then another set, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, I think, that make up the 0. And they're doing some sort of skywriting. 7-0 for the Army's 70th anniversary. So it's kind of fun to see that. So thanks to Mick. Mick always finds really strange things to send us, and we appreciate that.
Hey, Max, did they do that with flares? Or
I was going to say that what was made this really interesting is those aircraft were popping flares out of the top of them. To form the, since each one popped its own flare, it formed the letters in the formation. But yeah, I've never seen skywriting done with phosphorescence flare before. That's pretty impressive.
Yeah, and it wasn't just 170, right?
No, they keep doing it down the chain. Yeah, they pop one flare at a time every so often.
Yeah, I think I saw 3 times that they did it.
All right. Well, that's it for this episode of the Airplane Geeks podcast. Again, our guest was Igor Sikorsky III. Igor, it's always a pleasure to have you on the show. Fascinating stuff. We just got a little bit of a taste for what people can find at the Sikorsky weekends, and we want to thank you for that.
I enjoyed the whole thing. You guys are awesome. Thank you so much for inviting me and keeping this stuff alive. You got a good following.
Thank you. And, of course, you can learn more at bradfordcamps.com. You can find us at airplanegeeks.com. And if you want to go straight to the show notes for this episode, where we have lots of links and photos and videos and all the stuff that we talked about, you can get to that straight away by visiting airplanegeeks.com/491. Now let's tell folks where they can find us online. And Brian Coleman, let's start with you.
The best place for people to get a hold of me is at brian@airplanegeeks.com. Oh, and I'm sorry. I also wanted to mention, just because I haven't done it in a while, if people want to go back and listen to all the previous episodes, it's at airplanegeeks.com/archive.
Good. Okay. And Max Trescott, where do we find you?
Well, if you want to talk about anything related to general aviation, and especially about Cirrus, head out to aviationnewstalk.com, click on contact, or check out our show wherever you find podcasts.
And David Vanderhoof.
Well, you can find me on Twitter, you can find me, if you can spell Vanderhoof, or you can find me on our other social media platforms. And I'll give a shout out to our Slack listener team. We don't talk about that much on this show, but if you'd like to join the Power People and Brian occasionally, you can join our Slack team by sending us an email to thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com, and we'll send you an invite, and you can join the conversation the other 7 days of the week you're not listening to the podcast. And of course, you can always listen to me and that guy, Max Flight, talking about UAVs and flying taxis, and at least an episode once a week of the FAA on the UAVdigest.com.
Great. And you know what I forgot to mention at the very start, that Rob Mark wasn't going to be able to make it. I forgot all about that. So I'll correct that right now and say that Rob wasn't with us this episode. Wasn't that he was just very, very quiet. He had a good reason for not being able to make it, which I, for the life of me, can't remember right now. So you can find me on Twitter at MaxFlight. Look for me on LinkedIn, as David said, at the UAVDigest.com. Also with Mary Kirby on PaxXPodcast.com. Our outro is by Bruno Massone. You can find more of his compositions that incorporate aviation sounds at BrunoMassone.com. So please join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Bye, everybody.
Fly safely. Keep the blue side up.
Bye, everybody.
Oh, Rob is here.
And thanks for listening.
Okay, that's enough. We'll be right back.